Good afternoon. Welcome to the Double Line event. My name is Ron Riddell. I'm president of the Double Line Funds. On behalf of Double Line, I'd like to thank all of you for your support. In addition, we'd like to thank many partners here that have helped us launch joint products. Some of the representatives here today are partnerships with AMG, AXA, MassMutual, River North, and State Street. Representatives from these firms will be around here today. As your clients look to you for investment counsel to help them better their financial future, we believe now more than ever is the time for leadership. I have the honor of introducing Jeffrey Gundlach, who has offered that thought leadership for decades. Mr. Gundlach continues to offer our clients and partners unique perspectives on the financial market. Mr. Gundlach has been well recognized for his thought leadership and market calls. Mr. Gundlach has provided useful, timely information that our clients can apply to better navigate the global markets. Even his peers have recognized Mr. Gundlach's thought leadership in the financial markets. In 2017, Jeffrey was inducted into the Fixed Income Analyst Society Hall of Fame, and multiple years has been named Bloomberg Markets 50 Most Influential. However, Jeffrey Gundlach is much more than just a leader in financial markets. As CEO and founder of Double Line, he has built one of the most successful and fastest-growing asset management firms. Having 45 individuals follow him over from a previous company speaks to his ability to lead and motivate others to try to be the best that they can be. I know firsthand that he cares deeply in helping investors navigate through challenging market environments. Not only has he created an incredible company for 215 employees and their families, but he is also a major philanthropist. Recently, Jeffrey gave the largest single donation to a public institution in Buffalo, the Albright Knox Art Museum, soon to be renamed AKG, the Albright Knox Gundlach Museum. Please join me in welcoming the founder and CEO of Double Line, Mr. Jeffrey Gundlach.
Well, thank you, Ron, and thanks everyone for coming today. One of the most common complaints that people make about some of my presentations is that there's no specific investment recommendations. So since I did the Iris Sohn conference yesterday, and that requires specific investment recommendations, I thought that I know a few of you may have been there, but probably not most, and I thought I'd begin with that about 15 minutes, and then we'll get into the We'll get into a broader discussion of bond markets and the economy. So on the screen here is an artist named Ed Ruscha, who's still alive today. Lumped into the category of pop art, Ed Ruscha has delivered wryly detached portraits of the ephemera of our lives for over five decades. Through his lens, font-specific words are elevated as objects and bestowed something of an iconic status. Rather than simply painting a word, Ruscha considers the particular font, shape, color, and composition that might add an elevated emotion to the word's meaning, much the way a poet considers a phrase's cadence and consonants to make the hearing enhance the meaning. Ruscha's work underscores the idea that while words and phrases are purported to have meanings, they are in actuality subject to interpretations that can change swiftly and significantly. Let's look at a few examples of changing interpretations. Back in 2006, people thought the idea of the government sending checks to virtually all citizens was a ridiculous idea. They called it helicopter money. There was a poll in 2006 of Americans, and 12% of Americans were then in favor of the government sending out helicopter money. As of early this year, the survey number is now 48% of Americans are in favor of something that is called a much happier name than helicopter money. It's called universal basic income. So meanings change. In fact, there's a Democratic candidate named Andrew Yang, who from the Bay Area, I think, who's throwing his hat in the ring for the Democratic Party in 2020, running on the central platform of universal basic income. So watch out for this, because from 2006 to 2018, it went from 12 to 48. That's about 3 points per year. We've got about 2.5 years before the election. If that trend continues, it will go to over 50%, making it potentially a winning issue. Another thing that went from good to bad that relates to financial markets We're part of the mortgage-backed securities market, many of you know, that I began with in my career. They repackaged Ginnie Mae's into something called collateralized mortgage obligations, and this became a very popular activity in 1993. Many investment managers were piling into them because they had some characteristics that had worked. But then the bear market of 1994 came, and amazingly, the nomenclature changed, and they didn't call them CMOs anymore. They called them derivatives. And I was managing money for a lot of pension plans. There was one in Memphis, Tennessee, where a fellow named Selden Green was the caretaker. And he was a very nice Southern gentleman, and I was there for a review. And I had started buying some of these bombed-out, complicated mortgage-backed securities that had fallen about 45% in price during an interest rate rise. And he called me into his office, and he said, "Jeffrey, we are very concerned about these derivatives in the portfolio. We read in the newspaper, my trustees are very concerned." And I said, "Well, Selden, I understand, because they are given a lot of negative press, but let's try a thought experiment. Instead of calling them derivatives, let's call them good things." I said, "Selden, we are indeed buying a fair quantity of these good things for your pensioners, and they are down 45% in value, but that puts them at a point where you basically can't lose. If we have applied the worst possible assumptions, and I really literally mean a bookend of the worst possible assumptions, you will outperform virtually every other part of the bond market, maybe by a little, but if you don't get the worst possible outcome, it will be extremely successful. And by the way, these are government guaranteed, so you will get 100 back, and we're buying them at like 55 cents on the dollar. And by the way, they have a coupon of about 8%. So good and bad. Disinflation was considered to be great in 1980. Inflation had been spooking investors from the early part of the 1970s, and people didn't even want to believe, they didn't dare believe that inflation could actually be tamed. Disinflation was so great. Of course, now, disinflation is something that people don't like. The Federal Reserve is begging for more inflation and lamenting the fact that they say they can't get to 2%, even though the CPI is above 2%, so it's kind of odd. Again, interpretations. So inflation was such a problem in 1994 that President Ford launched the Whip Inflation Now campaign, in which he asked Americans to send him a list of inflation-reducing ideas, apparently because he didn't have any himself. 10 days later, he declared inflation public enemy number one, kind of what people call deflation today, and he vowed to fight it with the win button. And I actually still have my win button from 1974. I actually got one. He wanted you to fill out a form pledging yourself to be a soldier in the battle against inflation. And if you did, you got a win button. And he vowed to fight it with a win button and introduced some steps to take inflation down. These steps included ridiculous ideas like carpooling. Carpooling was going to reduce inflation. And turning down your thermostat was supposed to reduce inflation. The campaign was later described as, quote, one of the biggest government public relations blunders ever. Win buttons immediately became objects of ridicule. Skeptics wore them upside down and explained that NIM stood for Nonstop Inflation Merry-Go-Round. Alan Greenspan, who was then the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, when the concept was first presented to him, said, quote, "This is unbelievably stupid." Now, of course, inflation is desired. What's interesting, and I have some slides more on this in the second part of this presentation, is inflation is already looking like it's at 2% and maybe headed higher. There's a couple of indicators that DoubleLine has focused in on that give us a good lead time idea on where CPI might be going. This is core CPI, which is the yellow line. You'll notice the core CPI, as well as the headline, are above 2%. So I'm not sure what these Fed governors are talking about when they say they're challenged. Maybe they're looking at the personal consumption expenditure deflator that they used to look at, but the CPI is already at 2%. And it's led by real GDP with an 18-month lead as the best fit with a correlation of nearly 0.8, which the statisticians in here know is very high. And your eye can see that it is a good leading indicator. And you'll notice that real GDP, the white line, has moved higher. We've plotted it with an 18-month lead, and now, true to form, the core CPI is responding, with an acceleration. We can also see the same type of lead behavior from the ISM PMI, which is a 21 lead time for the best fit, again with a correlation of nearly 0.8. And again, it turned up the white line, the ISM PMI, pretty sharply a couple years ago. And look, sure enough, we see core CPI moving higher. Based upon these indicators, one might even think inflation is headed to 3%. Now, one of the things that is typical of late cycle investing, and I've heard people saying we're not late cycle, my friend, and who I respect greatly, Ed Hyman, is putting out data saying that we're not late cycle, but I find that hard to believe given this is already the second largest expansion in post-war history. But at any rate, I think we're not mid-cycle. I think we're late cycle, whether it's ninth inning or extra innings or seventh inning stretch, I don't know, but it doesn't really matter. My point is that leading into recessions, which are the red vertical bars, you always, going back to 1972, always have a massive increase in the total return of the commodity sector, here represented by Goldman Sachs Commodity Index. And lo and behold, you'll see it starting to rise. I was on CNBC December 13th. It was Fed Day, and I was asked, you know, getting late in the year, what's your best call for 2018? I said commodities. Since December 13th, commodities, the CRB index, is up about 10%, non-annualized from that time period. But the point is that it would be completely consistent for commodities to do well if we're indeed late cycle and ultimately heading into a recession, which we don't see right now, but there are a couple of indicators that are weakening in terms of their strength, and we'll get to that. Also, we can compare the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index total return to that of the S&P 500. When the yellow line goes up, commodities are outperforming. When the yellow line goes down, the S&P is outperforming commodities. And again, you'll notice a massive spike in the performance of commodities versus the S&P. That's partially due to commodities going up, as we saw in the previous exhibit, and partially due to the fact that going into recessions, the stock market gets a whiff of the trouble to come and starts to fall. It's interesting that the total return difference here has stopped going down for commodities versus stocks. So it's not even a value trap anymore. It's not cheap and getting cheaper. It's cheap and staying cheap, but now starting to show little signs of life. So one of the things that I take away from this is oil is a very important commodity. Energy sector broadly is a very important subset of the commodity sector. And here we have the white line is WTI, West Texas Intermediate, over the last 3 years. And the yellow line is a certain sector. This is an ETF, XOP, which is the energy exploration and production ETF. And you'll notice that as oil was moving down, the yellow line went down in sympathy. And when oil bottomed, the XOP started to outperform the S&P. And then we see that oil took off starting in the middle of 2017, and XOP has not really performed very well relative to oil. And so one could expect there to be some catch-up potentially from XOP. If we go back and look at exactly the same exhibit but using 5 years, you can see how typically highly correlated WTI is with outperformance or underperformance of the energy exploration ETF. And you'll notice that those alligator jaws exist here too. Also, the chart, this is just charting out the last 4 years of XOP versus the S&P 500. The technicians in the room will notice that this chart, you just want to fall in love with it. It's broken its downtrend line, the white line. It's triple bottomed. Just notice the white horizontal line at the bottom. And it's punched above its now rising 200-day moving average. So it wouldn't be all that strange to expect this thing to rally a significant amount. Now, the problem with this idea is, what if we run into a recession? It might go up first, which is historically typical for commodities broadly. But once the recession comes, I think oil is going to suffer. And these companies would suffer. So it's a little bit risky to want to be exposed since we're so late cycle. So we'll get to another idea that helps to buffer that in a moment. So here's another last chart on the energy sector. This is not just XOP, it's the energy sector as defined within the S&P 500. The energy sector weighting the S&P 500 is extraordinarily low, thanks to the poor performance of energy. Even though oil has gone up, it's a little bit of an anomaly, but you'll notice it's all the way back down to basically historical low levels going back nearly 30 years. So one might expect that energy will outperform the S&P 500. So This is a fellow named Jesse Livermore, one of the greatest investment legends of all time. Jesse Livermore was a speculator. And what he meant by that is he didn't believe it was his strength to be a so-called investor. He didn't really invest so much on, you know, balance sheets. He invested more on social mood and on chart patterns and sentiment. And he had famously said, one should never let speculative ventures to run into investments. That's 100 years ago he said that, so the jargon's a little different. What he meant is don't hold on to speculative investments and let them turn into long-term investments. Well, what he's really saying is the old joke, you know the definition of a long-term investor, don't you? A trader who's underwater, right? They hold on to it because they don't want to sell at a loss. Jesse Livermore has a tremendous amount of street cred. In the panic of 1907, which J.P. Morgan sort of bailed out the financial system, Livermore made $1 million, not in today's money, in 1907 money, $1 million in a day. He ended up losing it all because he listened to somebody's tip about cotton. And one of his rules was never listen to tips, but he violated his own rule. Also, just to really take this to another level, in the 1929 stock market crash, Livermore made $100 million by betting against the stock market in the United States. That's not in today's money. That's in 1929 money. Depending on how you think about inflation, that's minimally $2 billion. This isn't somebody like me that's money other people's money for a fee. This is a guy that started with a small stake and turned it into $2 billion through speculation. So a lot of street cred there. He said, speculation is correct anticipation of the psychological effect news will have on the mind of the public. In the book written by Edwin Lefebvre, which I recommend to everybody in this room, I've read it virtually the whole thing. I've read about 7/8 of it because I don't want to finish it because I want to savor that last eighth because the book is so good. It's called Reminiscences of a Stock Operator, certainly the best financial book ever written. And it's based upon the career of Livermore. And I'm going to paraphrase from one of the chapters. The book was actually written as a series of essays for publication in a newspaper, but then they were put together. So each chapter tells its own story. And it was done with Mr. Lefebvre interviewing Livermore personally. So some of this may be fictionalized, some of it is clearly based in fact. But here's what one of the lessons is in a abbreviated format. In the spring of 1906, it was a bull market. The outlook was favorable for general business, and the stock market had slowed down, but the tone was firm, and all indications pointed to higher prices. My friend, who was quite bullish, began to tell me what an obviously wise thing it was to hold stocks for much higher prices. I walked over to a table where there were some blank order pads. I wrote an order to sell the market and handed it to the manager. What are you doing? Asked my friend. I'm selling, I told him. The next day, we got the news of the San Francisco earthquake. But the market opened down only a couple of points. The bull forces were at work, and the public never is independently responsive to news. If there is a solid bull foundation, certain news items fail to have the effect they would have if the street were bearish. It's all the state of sentiment at the time. In this case, the street did not appraise the extent of the catastrophe because it did not wish to. Before the day was over, prices came all the way back. Give them time, I said, meaning prices. What would you do, I asked my friend, buy on the strength of the millions of dollars of the damage suffered? Where are the earnings for dividends going to come from after they pay for all they've lost? My friend said, I tell you, the market doesn't agree with you, and the tape doesn't lie, does it? I said, it doesn't always tell the truth on the instant, but it was exasperating to see the blindness of the street. I spoke of political blunders and changing interpretations. The two came together in a historic way with Michael Dukakis and the tank, now called Dukakis and the tank. It's a euphemism for when something goes terribly wrong with a media event. In this epic fail, Dukakis is the poster child for disingenuous. He was accused of being soft on defense. So he thought he'd get around that by showing how tough he was on defense by rolling around in a huge tank in an oval, taking the tank in front of a grandstand filled with press, including Sam Donaldson, among many others, And all at once, spontaneously, all the reporters exploded in laughter. It said that Sam Donaldson was literally doubled over laughing at how ridiculous the stunt. Because after all, look at this. I don't believe him. Hard on defense. You don't believe him. And he doesn't believe it himself. I mean, really? That preppy shirt and tie tough guy? Really? I mean, at least you could put on some fatigues, right? But here he is, actually keeping on that shirt and tie. And after you make a mistake like this, which was in September of 1988, you better make darn sure that you don't make another blunder of significance. But under a month later, Mike didn't exactly charm his way into voters' hearts during the 1988 debates with his response to the question from CNN's Bernard Shaw, which was the first question of the debate. Senator or Governor, you've been famously against the death penalty, but if your wife were raped and murdered, would you favor the death penalty for the killer? So Dukakis ended up just ignoring the context, showing no empathy whatsoever, and said, nope, and I've opposed the death penalty all of my life. To viewers, this answer seemed dispassionate, dismissive, and phony, as if to prove he is robotic and not forthcoming. So back to Livermore, one of his famous quotes, nothing new ever occurs in the business of speculating. What has happened in the past will happen again and again and again, just like Dukakis' blunder happened again. So speaking of not forthcoming, dispassionate and dismissive and again, let's talk about Zuckerberg and the apology, which may go down as Dukakis and the tank. So we all know about the data breach back. And in March, he says, I'm really sorry that this happened. What's he talking about? This happened. Not we did something wrong. Just, I'm really sorry that this happened. It's kind of like, you know, the husband. I'm really sorry you caught me cheating on you. And then here's, it's my mistake, and I'm sorry. That was a month later. It's better. This is in front of Congress. But again, it, very nonspecific, it. What does it mean? It was my mistake. It's like Bill Clinton when he said, depends on what the meaning of is, kind of hiding underneath semantics. So I think the next apology is an apology too far. In fact, I think we're already one apology too far. And I can bet your bottom dollar there's never one cockroach in the kitchen. There's going to be another one. In fact, there might be one motivated by events this very day. And by the way, this is not his first rodeo. Another apology. I apologize for any harm done. Again, very dismissive as a result of my neglect. At least he's taking responsibility. That was back in November of 2003. So the apology tour has been happening again and again and again. So for Facebook, the bloom is off the rose. It used to be a place that made people feel good. Now it's become a place that makes people feel bad. And the bulls on Facebook say, hey, it's a huge company, globally dominant. They have 2.2 billion users. When I hear 2.2 billion users, though, I hear 2.2 billion compliance breaches, which sounds like a lot. Also, social media sounds very, very, has this warm and fuzzy kind of aura around it. But maybe it's iSpy media, or opioid media, or election media, or opt-out media, or bullying media. Interpretations change. Speculation is the correct anticipation of how the public will react to the news. So the bulls are still clinging to the argument, regulation prices out competition. What are you talking about? There isn't any competition now. They buy their competitors. They do have barriers to competition because they buy them, like Instagram. But Lindsey Graham pointed out in the congressional testimony, aren't you a monopoly? And if you remember, Zuckerberg's answer was, duh, it doesn't feel like it. So once the regulators show up, things tend to get ugly. And for Congress, there's really only two gears to regulation. There's nothing and overreaching. So now that we're going to get off of nothing, we'll probably go with the historical pattern of overreaching. You can see the blue line was when the Supreme Court found Big Tobacco liable for cigarette deaths. You can see what happened to the value of tobacco. And then we see the yellow line, which was a couple years ago when the U.S. tightened regulations on biotech. And you'll notice what happened to biotech. And here we are with privacy fears sparking regulation. And of course, Facebook is right dead center in that. Also, the chart on Facebook looks absolutely terrible. We see here that it has a head and shoulders type of a pattern to it. It then broke down below the horizontal line of support. Now it's struggling to try to make it back to its yellow 200-day moving average and not making it. And today it's broken down again. Livermore had rules about trading, his speculations. And this is actually Livermore's speculative chart. He shows how stocks should be behaving. You'll notice it says test before selling short. And he's got kind of a stylized example of how a stock might trade. And he said, do not trust your opinions, but let the action of the market confirm your opinion. So what he's basically saying is let it sell off and then test if upper right, test before selling short. So once a stock had broken downwards, Livermore would sell. Well, and by the way, that's where Facebook was at the close of Friday, right there on the schematic of Livermore's chart. So here's just Facebook with a 200-day moving average and volume down at the bottom. Livermore would sell a stock short once it had broken downwards, and he would look for signs that the new trend was behaving normally, so he would stick with the trade. These signs were the following. At the beginning of the move, there should be an unusually large amount of shares traded. Look at that huge spike down at the bottom. That's volume at the bottom. Look at the big spike on the breakdown in March. Prices should move generally downward for a few days at least, and of course they did. And then he would call for a normal reaction, which is what he termed it, which is defined as a move against the new trend on decreased volume. You notice that happened until last Friday, with it going back up to the breakdown point exactly, as we saw earlier, and then breaking down. And then volume should increase, which I'm sure it did today. So Facebook is like a classic textbook short candidate from one of the, using the rules of one of the greatest trader speculators of all time. So specific recommendations, long energy. We don't want to be exposed to recession, however. I believe if there's a recession, Facebook will collapse, probably collapse even without a recession, but certainly if there is a recession, all stocks will drop as a general rule. Oil stocks will drop once the recession hits, but Facebook, just like in 01 when the NASDAQ had been booming, the NASDAQ then fell parts of it like 85% in the bear market. And so here's the last chart on this. This is oil and gas versus the S&P, versus Facebook. So take a look at this chart, another thing of beauty. You just want to marry it. I mean, here it's found a bottom way back in 2017, almost a year ago. It's been tracing out a nice bottom. Now it's punching higher above its rising 200-day moving average. I didn't draw the trend line in, but it's also broken its downtrend line. So this seems to be a really good pair trade. Now, last from Livermore, Wall Street never changes. The pockets change, the suckers change, the stocks change, but Wall Street never changes because human nature never changes. All right, let's talk about inflation in the economy. Is the U.S., is it possible to find signs of a recession? Now, you're going to go through some indicators. Most of these have visibility for about 3 to 6 months. So if it's good news, we don't see a lot of recession signs. The bad news is it's not for a long, long time. But here are some of the most important ones. What we've got here is the shaded blue area. That's kind of the second and third quartile dispersion of recessions going back for decades. And the vertical line, that's the front edge of the recession as it was officially declared. And the blue area is basically the first quartile and fourth quartile, the 50% in there of how the leading indicators behaved going to the front of the recession. The point is that you'll notice that the blue shaded area is strikingly weak. It's going down in a persistent way going into that recession. It goes below zero. The yellow line is where we are right now, just using the assumption, this is no prediction whatsoever, let's just assume that we think that we might have a recession in 12 months. How does this look? Does this corroborate the idea that recession's coming in the next 12 months? The answer is obviously no, unless these leading indicators start falling in a definitive way pretty much right away. So that doesn't look recessionary. Same exercise for the ISM PMI. It is started to fall a little bit, but again, you see a lot of decline in the year going into the front edge of a recession. This is something to keep our eye on, certainly not flashing any significant caution now. It's not rising anymore, but it's certainly not in a downtrend. Let's look at measures of business and consumer sentiment. The red shaded area is the last recession, and us all of them, we've consumer confidence, CEO confidence, home builder confidence, small business optimism, and then the white line's the average. You'll notice going into the last recession, all of them are very observably in the decline, and they go below basically this zero level right around the start of the recession. Of course, we're very near the highs, so not looking at a recession here. And then the granddaddy of them all, which is probably the most important to a bond-trained person like me, is the spread of credit using high yield to treasury bonds. So here we have the blue shaded area. That's the front edge of recession, the x-axis. That would read as zero if we had that kind of granularity in this in the numbers. But basically, how do high yield spreads behave relative to treasuries going into a recession? And we have the last two recessions. The blue line is 01. And you'll notice that basically a year and a half or so before the recession came, you could see high yield spreads versus treasuries really substantially expanding from about 500 basis points out to 900 basis points before the recession came. So a 400 basis point widening. And then we see the 07 recession where it happened about 6 months before the recession, but again, about a 400 basis point widening. This is not wiggles and jiggles. This is something that is, this is what I call the big rock. And I'm not going to go into that story because I don't want to take all of your time, but if you want to go back and listen to the big rock story, it was in the Just Market webcast, January 8th. It's up on replay at doubleline.com. Not doubleline funds, doubleline.com. And so here's where we are now. If we assume that we're kind of 6 months into recession, it's the white line. It's got to start going up like immediately to exhibit the same pattern of back in 07. And there's another line that's green. It's hard to see, but that assumes a recession in a year. And again, spreads should start widening if it's going to look like the 01 recession. But spreads have gone out a little bit, but you need a magnifying glass. This is not, you know, this is not something that you need a magnifying glass to see on historical terms. So let's talk about the Fed and the deficit, which is one of the problems that the bond market's been having recently. And I've been talking about this for years, frankly, that was coming, and now we're pretty much on the doorstep, is the supply of treasury bonds and other debt is going to get very big, the Fed and the deficit. It's interesting, I didn't put on the, starting with Paul Volcker, which was the beginning of the bull market in bonds, every successive Fed chairperson was shorter in height than the one before. So that the lower trend in interest rates was mirrored by the lower trend in height of Fed chair people. I have no idea why those two correlated together, but yet it's happened again. Because Janet Yellen was pretty short, and then here comes Jay Powell, and he's up there at about 5'11 or so, so now the trend of height has changed. So, you know, I'm not sure I'd use that as probing analysis, but it is interesting that it has actually happened. So, and interestingly, the deficit's gonna kind of go along with that. So the U.S. budget deficits of percentage of GDP got very bad, 10%. Back in the aftermath of the financial crisis. But weirdly, this late in the cycle, we see the deficit expanding again, and the tax plan, as we all know, is going to expand the deficit very substantially. The estimates are that $280 billion of revenue are going to disappear, and that spending could ramp up by $400 or $500 billion. And you put that together, and you go from about a $500 billion deficit at its nadir to what is now predicted to be 1.1 to 1.3, depends who you talk to, but over a $1 trillion deficit. And in the last several months, we've been running about $100 billion a month. So we're kind of back on track to about $1.2 trillion. And don't forget that this is not the only debt that needs to be floated. We also have quantitative tightening going on. So let's look at the budget deficit. Back in 2017, it was about $650 billion. It was lower than that in 2016, but then it ramped up to about $900 billion. Fiscal 2018 ends in September. Fiscal 2019 starts in October. That's not very far away. It's only about 6 months away, 5 months away to the start of October. And here's a from the CRFB, we have a $1.1 trillion deficit prediction, and then staying up there at a big number. Now, this is not assuming any recession. This is assuming continuous growth. Now, if there's a recession, they may stop quantitative tightening, which is scheduled to be as large as $600 billion for fiscal 2019, which means, let's just use the high estimate of $1.3 trillion on the deficit, $600 billion of QT. We're at $1.9 trillion of Treasury bonds being floated as a base case, nearly triple where we were two short fiscal years ago. So the bond market is kind of waking up to this. If you look at positioning in the bond market, there's a lot of shorts. A lot of shorts on the 10-year. Earlier this year, there was record short positioning against the 10-year. What's interesting is as the bond market has sold off, those shorts have not covered. So there's an old adage that you need buying to push prices higher, whether it's stocks or bonds. You need real buying to push prices higher, but markets can fall of their own weight because all you need is an absence of buying, and prices have to get marked down. You don't need outright selling. So the short position hasn't been covered, but the bond market continues to fall. We'll get into that. Here's the central bank activity. The Fed is in gray. So the Fed is already at negative quantitative easing, quantitative tightening. Their balance sheet is shrinking, and they're ramping it up. They're doing it carefully, and I applaud them for that, because who knows what would happen if we just suddenly did $50 billion of additional bond sales a month. So they're ramping it up, trying to make sure, although once it doesn't look good, it'll be too late. Of course, that's the way Fed tightening works, too. They're back in their mode where they're tightening unless the data changes. That all flipped about 2 years ago when previously, we'll tighten when the data gets better. Now it's, we'll tighten unless the data gets worse. And so they'll be waiting for the data to get worse. And once it does, it'll be too late. But this is one reason to think a recession may come in a year or so, even though the indicators don't say it in the next 3 or 6 months. And then we see that the ECB, which is in light blue, they're ramping down their quantitative easing, and they start quantitative tightening in about a year, a little more. And then we see even the BOJ is doing less. So if balance sheet expansion was bullish for financial assets, and it sure seems like it was, kept interest rates low-ish, and it kept stocks powering ahead through all of 2017, there wasn't even a drawdown of 3% peak to trough using closing data in 2017, which is really remarkable when you had a 22% return for the S&P, probably the best risk-adjusted return for the S&P 500 you will ever have in your investment lifetime. Was last year. And of course, just like in the physical world, things tend to flip and mean revert. I mean, I like to point out that Death Valley, which is the lowest spot in the lower 48, is right next to Mount Whitney, the highest spot in the lower 48. That's not a coincidence. All that dirt from Death Valley has to go somewhere, and it goes to Mount Whitney. And the lowest volatility of all time for that type of market gain, 2017, not surprisingly, 2018 is opened up as an incredible volatility year. Last summer, I was asked on TV, what's your biggest conviction? I said that volatility will go up. The VIX is going to go to 20. And as they always do, somebody came on for a couple hours afterwards. They asked guests about what I said, and they all said that I'm an idiot, that the VIX will never go up again. Never, there's that word. A woman came on and said the VIX will never go over 15 again because of structural changes. And as I've said before, in the investment world, when you hear the word never, it means it's about to happen. And sure enough, the VIX was at 17 the next day, from 9.82 to 17 the next day after all of these guests said, never will it go up. Now, of course, this year, once it broke out back on January 29th above 15, it hasn't been below 15 again. I'm pretty sure the VIX probably went up today, although it had been settling down in recent time periods. Not only is the government borrowing trillions of dollars, but the S&P 500, this is emblematic of the corporate bond market. It's only a subset of the corporate bond market, but this is a good placeholder for what's happening in corporate America. Corporate bonds have not had maturities in recent years because appropriately and sensibly, the CFOs extended their maturities. They liked low rates. They wanted to lock them in, and they liked tight spreads to make it even more attractive to lock in. But now we start to see big supply coming out. Now, this is just the S&P 500. In the corporate bond market, there will be about $500 billion. In the junk bond plus loan market, about $500 billion as we move towards fiscal 2020. So we're talking about maybe $3 trillion of bonds starting to hit the market. Now, people have warned about, you know, walls of maturities before, but we're now in what could arguably be termed a rising rate environment, which I'll get to in a moment. But that doesn't make it all that easy to float all these bonds. And who's going to buy them? Here's the Japanese, their activity on treasury holdings. You see, they stopped buying treasuries 3 years ago, so they're not buying them. And there's this argument, which is false, and I'm going to explode it in a few slides later. There's this weird argument here on CNBC, again, interpretations that are wrong. that U.S. bonds are wickedly attractive to Europeans and Japanese because our yield on the 10-year is nearly 3%, and in Germany they're at 50 basis points-ish, and in Japan they're down at nearly zero. So it's wildly attractive for them to buy our bonds. Wrong, wrong, wrong. Couldn't be more wrong, and I'll prove that. That's one of the reasons why the Japanese aren't buying. Our bonds are not attractive. The nominal yield is higher, but I'll give you a preview. They have to hedge the currency, and that's very expensive. So a little bit more on inflation, maybe a little bit more globally. And, you know, inflation, as I said earlier, everybody hated it. Now everybody wants it. So his Uncle Sam, you know, you remember how to fly this thing, right? Because once inflation gets out of control, it gets way out of control. When the whip inflation now ridiculous campaign came out, the CPI was at 12.3. So it got above 4 and then went to, which was considered to be a very high level in the 60s, and it went to 12.3, and now we have to do something. Here's the inflation in Germany, where you see the ridiculous level of their yields. This goes back, it's just updated through today. We can see that their 10-year is now at 63 basis points. That's a very bad sign. It's one of the reasons why bonds are selling off the United States. They're having a hard time controlling the German Bund at 50 basis points, which is their new desire. First, they wanted 25. They couldn't keep it together. It went to 50. It stayed there for a while, and then all of a sudden it blew out to 78, and then all the manipulation came, and they managed to buy it back down to 50 from the ECB. But now, as of last night, it broke up to 63. That's a bad sign. It's putting pressure on other yields. And then we see the inflation rate, the yellow line, is vastly lower. Notice all the way up until 2011, yields in Germany were always higher than the inflation rate. There was a real yield. Now, for the past 2 years, with their manipulation, there's a negative real interest rate. It's absolutely board-certified insane to own German bunds, I would think, because you're paying people, you're paying the government interest. It's crazy. They're supposed to pay you interest. So capacity utilization in Germany is also pretty robust, which would suggest the potential for higher inflation. It's all the way up at 88. Here in the United States, historically, we say capacity utilization above 80 or certainly 82 usually creates inflation pressure. Well, this is way higher than that. Even in Japan, there's little signs that inflation might have bottomed out. We've got some CPIs on here, some exclude some categories, but you can see gentle uptrends. And producer prices in the G4, US, Eurozone, UK, and Japan were heavily negative. They've stopped rising, but they're certainly looking like around 2% or so. So what is this talk about we can't get inflation at 2%? And, you know, it's a little bit worrisome. Here we are late in the cycle. We have fiscal stimulus, which is unprecedented to do something when the economy is growing this well, this late in the cycle, you know. And here we have people talking about we wish we could get inflation, but open your eyes. It's staring you in the face. The CPI core is at 2.1. G3 wages are rising a little bit, but look at the number here. The U.S. is up there at around 2.7%. We see the magenta line, average weekly earnings up a little higher than that, and then even in the Eurozone, and that's in the U.K., higher than U.S., and then we see in the Eurozone, the green line, even there pushing towards 2%. What are their yields doing at 50 basis points? Here's the interesting picture of U.S. inflation. Do we have inflation or not? Well, it depends. You can break the CPI into two categories. One is services, which is the yellow line, which is pretty high. I mean, relative to the 2% Fed targets at 2.9 and appears to be starting to trend higher again. And then we have the white line, which is the Amazon effect, which is goods services core. We can see that it's been below zero pretty much for 4 years, maybe even 5 years below zero, the Amazon effect. But look at what it's doing. I mean, it is clearly starting to show some signs of life. So there's two ways for this to go right, and there's two ways for things to go wrong. Either core services could moderate, which would be positive for keeping inflation low, right? Or core goods could moderate and keep inflation low, but both are moving the other direction. So there's two ways for it to go wrong, that these trends continue and that inflation goes higher. And from those inflation models that we talked about in the investment cubism presentation, some of these indicators suggest 3% inflation. Here's some more that I didn't include in the other presentation, but more indicators. Here's the CPI with the New York Fed underlying inflation gauge that people don't pay enough attention to. It's a good indicator. It's got a 0.8 correlation with a lead time of 16 months, and this too suggests that maybe inflation is going higher. You'll notice the white line seems to be more volatile than the yellow line. So maybe we're not really predicting 3.1 inflation here, but something higher would be sensible. And look again how these indicators have worked. We created these indicators before CPI turned up. And in every case, we've not data mined here. These are indicators that were developed while CPI was falling. They all responded very much in sync with the historical modeling. And here's capacity utilization. This is a little less convincing because capacity utilization is not that robust. But again, it turned at about the same time. And here are just some measures of inflation using core PCE. So that's the one, the PCE down at 1.6, although that too, the magenta line, is starting to move higher, and we see the green and the all lines. So there's this strange interpretation that we keep hearing that there's no inflation, yet the best performing sector of the financial markets in U.S. United States since December 13 have been commodities, not stocks, certainly not bonds, commodities. So let's look at some more things. When I was a kid, my mom would take me to the grocery store. This was in the 70s, early 70s. And we would go shopping, and unbelievably, there were multiple price tags on bread, which doesn't have a long shelf life. There was a price tag on top of a price tag. They were marking them up intraday. And I was wondering why people didn't just take off to go down to the bottom one for the price from last night and save themselves some money, but that's the way the store operated. So this is meant to be a joke, whoever penned this, but it's actually, I have personal experience. What do you mean prices have gone up since I got in line? I experienced that. So let's look at some things the market's telling us. One thing is the stock market in the United States on a price-to-sales ratio was wickedly expensive on January 26th, which was the high. I have gone on record. I did while when we were at the high of the year, when we were up 7% year-to-date, I said stock market's going to close down this year, and it's down now. So what we see here is price-to-sales ratio is ridiculously high, higher than 1999 and way higher than 2007. That's on the index basis. If you equal weight the 500 companies and don't do it on the market cap weighted, which the index does, it's sickeningly expensive. This is because of the large companies having certain valuations on them. What's been going on internationally is very interesting. Here we have the global market going back a year. That's the dotted line is the return of the global market. And the S&P 500 has basically been exactly the same as the global market for the past year. Away from the United States, it's the tale of two different markets that make up the major part of the rest of the world. There's emerging markets, which have gone up 15% more than the global market. And we see MSCI Europe, which has gone up 11% less than the global market. So it's been very important what sectors you own. Many of you may know that my recommendation at the Barron's Roundtable in January of 2017 was emerging markets. And they've certainly done one, in particular India, which was a particularly strong performer. And I wanted to stay away from Europe. But your eye can see things might be changing a little bit. We're getting a little sign of life out of Europe. Maybe the market's starting to feel good about some of those better economic trends and that inflation news. And emerging markets have stopped outperforming the global market now for nearly 9 months. Here's another look. This goes back a long time where this picture is very different. Here we see the S&P 500 was the best performer going back to year-end 09, and Europe was still terrible, largely due to the last 3 or 4 years, and emerging markets have been pretty bad over that period. So there's been a kind of a sea change more recently in emerging markets. I don't like the trade location for emerging markets presently, but if you're really a long-term investor and not a Jess Livermore, you might stay with it. I think emerging markets will perform just fine relative to the global market, looking for a multi-year viewpoint. This near-term, not so much. So one of the funny messages from the market that certainly showed vulnerability for stocks up at that bubble peak, January 26, when my speech in January, what I was talking about was, yes, everything looks great, but what's obvious is obviously priced in. That's what people miss. It's priced in. People were saying, remember Goldilocks was the word of the day? Goldilocks. We were in a Goldilocks world for the market. And then it was, no, we've exited Goldilocks. We're now ecstatic. Ecstasy was the term that was quoted the week of January 26. It's ecstasy for stock investors. Yes, all the indications are so good, what's obvious is obviously priced in. You don't make money on the obvious. There's a guy named Joe Granville, who's one of the great technicians of the 70s. He said, what's obvious is obviously wrong. Kind of a twist on the same topic. What's interesting is junk bonds, this is the total return, I think it's just the prices. This is the price of the JNK ETF. You'll notice in 2016, the price of JNK very much followed the path of the S&P 500's price. They had almost the same return, and they zigged and zagged together. But it's almost like in December of 2016, somebody rang a bell. And they said, no, you know, something's changed here. And junk ETF price has been suffering. And you can see the incredible alligator jaws that developed between the S&P price and junk bonds. Just notice how junk bonds were super weak going into January 26th as the S&P 500 was hitting its all-time high. And then suddenly this massive volatility has developed. And now junk bonds remain weak. Not a good sign. Let's talk about the dollar, which is very critical to non-U.S. investing, obviously. The dollar goes in 6 or 8 year cycles with some predictability and regularity. You'll notice going in the late 70s, the dollar had a multi-year period. We've stylized this with this black line of underperformance, then a big run of outperformance with very little deviation, and then a big underperformance that was persistent, and then a persistent outperformance into 2002 or so, and then a big underperformance. And then we've just exited the big outperformance period. So the dollar's probably, in my view, has begun a multi-year downtrend, but not now, not in the short term, because here's the chart on the dollar, and we can see that it's gone. It broke above its uptrend, its downtrend line, and that this is the dollar index, and now it's checked back all the way down to that downtrend. It would be completely normal for the dollar to have a counter-trend rally. What Livermore might have called the normal reaction against the trend. And we can see that the dollar actually has shown signs of life recently. The dollar's at a local high. I think it's at the high of the year right now, or the high of the last few months anyway. And it's above, it's roughly at 91, which is something of a resistance point. But this is one of the reasons why emerging markets, when the dollar is strong, even over short-term periods, it's not good relative performance from emerging markets. We've seen that. So there's a few charts that I think are absolutely critical to watch. I have three of them in here, and this is really getting almost exciting because of how close we are to something big happening in the big markets. Here's gold, and gold has broken its downtrend line going back to 2011. Gold is maintaining an upward pattern above its rising 200-day moving average, which is extremely good, and it's not drawn on the screen because it's a little bit too busy, but let your mind draw the line connecting all of those tops. So take that top of 2016 where the white line gold kissed its downtrend line and kind of draw horizontal there. You'll notice that we've been hitting that as a resistance point for years. I mean, it goes back to 2013 just about. So we're coming on 5 years of bumping into this as a resistance point. And one of the things that people look at is once you've had a base built that's this big, if you break out, and I'm not even predicting it will, my point is you're at such a critical juncture that you should let the market, like Livermore said, let the market confirm your opinion. Don't just fall in love with your opinion. Let the market confirm it. Well, confirming the opinion would be a decisive break above that horizontal. I'm not predicting that will happen. We'll let the market talk. But if it happens, the move should be enormous because of the explosive potential energy of this huge, and you might even call it a head and shoulders bottom base. The measured move from classic chart reading, I hope you're ready for this, would be a move of $1,000 in gold. I'm not sure it's going to happen. I'm not predicting it. I don't want to see a story in anybody's newspaper that I'm predicting gold's going up $1,000. I'm letting the market prove itself. But you can see how big this base is. And we do have a general inflation sort of commodity up move. And maybe when the dollar heads down in earnest, which maybe it will and maybe it won't, that would be consistent. Let's talk about that. Well, we'll get to that next. Another thing, the 10-year. Look at that big head and shoulders base. Well, here we have the downtrend that goes back to 2009. We broke that downtrend 2 long years ago. Those of you that really follow what we do at Double I know we turn maximum bearish on 10-year yields and bonds generally. July 6th of 2016, the low close was basically that day or 2 days later. I think it was July 8th was the low close, but the low yield was literally hit that day. And we've remained in a bearish posture largely on rates since then. So those, I know many of you probably are invested in double line total return. If you take a look at the return since July 8th of 2016, they're incredibly strong because we've been positioned correctly for this general environment. Now, the 10-year Treasury has broken itself. Notice how it checked back. Remember how I talked about dollar was checking back to its downtrend? Notice how the 10-year yield in 2017 in September checked back to its downtrend, and it held. It held, and then it moved higher. So now we're in an interesting juncture. Will we break above that horizontal line, which is sort of 3%, 303, whatever it is, or will we see yields fall? Well, if we break above that level decisively, have a couple of closes, and certainly if we start accelerating higher, there's kind of nothing but air above the yield level until you get to 350 and maybe even 4% on the 10-year. So again, let the market do the talking. If the 10-year is a great short at 299, where it was when I walked up to this podium, then it's a great short at 306. Doesn't make any difference. Let the market do the talking. So there's a lot of people that think that because of monetary velocity being weak, and this is the fundamental argument of the bulls, the monetary base and the monetary velocity of M2 being weak, they think that you cannot get yields higher, and they have tremendous historical evidence that can help support that. But is historical evidence really that relevant today? You can make an argument that the manipulation from central banks and negative interest rates in Europe might mean that we'll have a different experience this time. You know, one of the things people talk about is the flat yield curve. You know, twos, tens, got to 42 basis points, and now it's been sitting at 50. Seems to really like being at 50. It's weird how the twos, tens spread is the same as the German 10-year yield. I'm not sure how that fits together, but that seems to be part of the puzzle. The twos, tens spread is flatter than it's been in a while, and a lot of people say that's something to be worried about. And I agree that it might be sending a message. Now, will the curve necessarily invert? People make the accurate observation when the 210 spread gets to 50 basis points, it invariably goes to flat or inverted. Maybe it goes a little higher first, but it's not long. It might be 2 years, maybe 1 year, but it's not terribly long before it goes inverted. And so it's, you know, we're waiting for that, wondering about that. But will the curve invert this time? I'm not so sure. Because even though it's inverted every time before recessions in the past, in Japan, where they had low interest rates for decades and still do, they had serial recessions, one after another, and the curve never inverted. And I think that might have to do with the absolute interest rate level. You know, when you're at really weirdly low manipulated interest rates, maybe the messages that are being sent aren't consistent with messages in the past. For example, back in the good old days when the 10-year Treasury yielded 8%, there was a moment when the 2-year Treasury yielded 8.50. And I can see why you'd still own the 10-year at 8, even though you get 8.50 in the 2-year, because 8's a real return. It's actually a pension plan's targeted return. So it's good. Lock it in. When you're down at 3 on the 10-year, you know, if the 2-year were at 3.50, would you really want a 3 10-year? I mean, it's just not that high of a rate. And so I think it might filter through. But this is really an exciting time period for the potential energy. And as I tweeted out in January at the top of the stock market, there's a lot of potential energy that's going to turn into kinetic energy. So the potential energy is the coiling, the compression of the range, and it creates kinetic energy later. So let's look at the message of the bond market. Okay, here's the 2-year Treasury. One of the questions I usually get asked in presentations like this, or have been asked for years, when are yields going to start rising? As I've said now for the past 4 years or so, they already are. The 2-year Treasury bottomed in 2011, 7 years ago. And is there anybody in this room that doesn't think this is an uptrend? I mean, seriously. The 2-year Treasury has been rising at a rate of 200 basis points annualized since September of last year. So it's rising pretty quickly. Here's the 5-year, you know, broke the trend line, almost checked back to it, couldn't even make it. It was so, the yield momentum was so strong, and boom. Again, clearly, this is an uptrend. Here's the 10-year Treasury. Here we go. Check back again. Amazing how these things kind of echo each other, so many of these charts. And we see the 10-year checked back 3 times, kissed its downtrend line. put in a classic double bottom from 2012 to 2016, even did the overthrow, which means going to a minor new low, below 139 to 136, and then rejecting it, and then boom, I mean, look at this thing going up. People that say we're not in an uptrend, what are you talking about? The yield has gone up 167 basis points, now 168 basis points from its low. So I don't know. These people, they say, oh, don't worry about rates. They're still low. No, no. Rates rising matters. You know, one of the great reasons to have a very high forward PE, which got to 20 times, earnings got marked up and stocks dropped. But in January, they were at 20 times forward earnings. That's only happened twice, in history. 1929, 1999. So not a great pattern. And so what you see is PE was very high. Well, it's okay to be high on a PE when interest rates are at zero. Newsflash, they're not at zero. One-year LIBOR is pushing 3% right now. One-year LIBOR has a higher yield than the S&P 500. Remember the argument for stocks, which was a good one a few years back? They yield more than the 10-year. Okay, well, they don't now. They don't even yield more than one-year LIBOR. So why should the PE be at the same level as it was when the 10-year was lower? And in particular, LIBOR, which has gone up, 240 basis points or so. So let's just do a little overlay here, which is sort of interesting, where we might be in this yield move. And this is suggestive that maybe this level will hold on the 10-year. I'm not in that camp, but my conviction is low. My conviction on breaking above 3 is low. I don't think you need conviction. Let the market prove your opinion. So we see that we've put in the bottom here from 2016, July 8th, 2016, which was the low, and we're just putting that green line on, which is the pattern of what happened afterwards, and then we're putting in the yellow line, which is the current up move from September of last year. And you can see it's kind of weird how they follow the same sort of wiggles and jiggles. The magnitude of the up move after 2016 was a little bit more robust, but it peaked out about the same time this move did, and then we consolidated, which we've had, and now we're going back up again. Based on that pattern, we might go a little bit higher still, but maybe not a lot. Now, here's that myth that I said I would explode, that our bonds are just irresistible for foreign investors. You have to hedge the currency. What if you didn't hedge the currency in 2017? You got mutilated, because not only did rates rise, but you had a massive currency loss on translation if you're a foreign. You have to hedge the currency, and it's very expensive. So actually, if you're a German investor, you can buy the red line, which is euro-denominated, 63 basis points, or you can buy the blue line, which is the U.S. 10-year hedged. It's a give. They're not attractive. The foreigners are not going to buy them. And then you see for the Japanese yields for Germans are even worse, but they're not much worse than U.S. And let's do the same experiment for 30-year yields for Japanese investors. So here we have hedging the currency again, and we can see that the hedged one is the black line. So a Japanese investor gets 65 basis points if they hedge our 30-year, when they can actually get a higher yield than that in other areas, including Japan, which is low, but it's still higher than the hedge. So don't expect foreigners to be clamoring into the bond market unless the hedging cost radically changes or the yield differential radically gets marked up. Now, here's one of the charts that I shouldn't be showing you because it's a secret. But it's such a good secret that I'm going to tell you. This is how you predict movements in the 10-year. The best way to do it for years and years and years, and it's a weird thing, you average nominal GDP in the United States and the German 10-year. And that average is the green line. And the yellow line is the generic 10-year U.S. Treasury yield. Incredible fit, right? Incredible. The only time it gets out of whack is during recessions or just after. Every other time period, it's the same line. I mean, look at how this has been accurate, not just in the broad trend, but almost in the monthly wiggles and jiggles. And what does it say? It says that the generic 10-year yield is a little too high right now. However, the German 10-year may be on the rise because it rose 13 basis points in the last few days, and nominal GDP in the United States may well go up. It may go up because of the tax package helping short-term boost to growth, and it may go up with some inflation rise that our model predicted. So maybe 10-year yields are about where they're supposed to be because nominal GDP may click higher when we get the next tick on U.S. GDP. It's an interesting chart. It's worth tracking. Now, there's a slide that we wanted to replace this one with. It's on the other computer, which is because it's more updated. This is the 10-year yield since quantitative tightening. It's really fascinating. What some people said is, gee, you know, what was counterintuitive is when they're doing quantitative easing, yields rose. It was weird. When they were buying the bonds, yields went up. And when they stopped buying them, yields went down. That's true. And I always thought that was because when they're doing quantitative easing, there was a boost. People thought it was a boost to the economy, so yields would go up. But a lot of people thought that since yields went up during quantitative easing, maybe they would drop during quantitative tightening, since it's exactly the opposite. Maybe it would have the opposite effect on the yield movement. But that's not true. Actually, this is what's been happening since tapering. And it's rather strongly suggestive that one of the culprits behind the yield rise is quantitative tightening, because the blue shaded area is the Fed's balance sheet cumulatively, and it's shrinking. And you'll notice that its shrinkage coincides very nicely with the sell-off or the increase in bond yields on the 10-year. You'll notice that the quantitative tightening has gone into a new gear in the last couple of months, and lo and behold, the 10-year Treasury has found it easier to free itself of the shackles of gravity over that time period. Very interesting. May have gone one too far there. Nope, that's fine. We'll go to the next one. So here's the last man standing, and it's really not standing very sturdily anymore. That's a 30-year treasury. It's broken its downtrend. So even this isn't looking all that strong for the bond bulls. However, we do have one last pivot point remaining, and that's where the downtrend line was kissed by the yield back in 2017, around March or so. You'll notice that it fell down back from that level, but we've broken above that. But that level where it kisses the downtrend is called a pivot point, and 322 is that pivot point. And amazingly, the high yield on the 30-year this year on a closing basis, which is what we always use, closing basis, was 322. We made it exactly, and then we got that little rally. But here we go again, and we're up at 317. And if we take out 322 on the 30-year, which is five small basis points away, I think it is not possible to make a chart case that there is anything supporting a bull market label to the bond market. So, and again, if 317 is a great sale on the 30-year, then 326 is too. So let the market do the talking. We don't even need to have an opinion. So I don't think this is a good place at all to be selling bonds on a trade location basis. The inflation doesn't look good. The nominal GDP in German thing may show out pressure. But purely from a trade location, we're channeling Jesse Livermore here today. On a trade location basis, this is a terrible time to be selling bonds because maybe 322 holds. I don't think it will, but my conviction isn't great. If 1 to 10 is the scale and I'm bearish at 1, and I have my conviction at 1 is very significant that one thing will happen, and 10 is very significant that the opposite will happen, I'm kind of at a 6. So on the margin, if you force me to put a trade on, I would not be buying bonds. I remain defensive on rates, but it's not terribly convicted. The market that has not yet signaled recession, as we talked about earlier, but looks as sick as a dog, is the JNK, which has broke below its 200-day moving average, the red line. Notice, see how it was bumping up against that pivot point back in 2014 over and over again? It looks like it hit it. That's that horizontal line that's drawn. It looks like it hit it about 20 times during 2017 and just couldn't do it. And then it broke below its 200-day moving average November 1st. So that's a while ago, right? That's almost 6 months ago, November 1st. And we've had exactly one day above the 200-day moving average since November 1st. This is a persistently weak JNK market, and now it seems to be being joined with equity volatility and the like. I tweeted out last September that when rates start rising, corporate bonds are the worst possible place to be. Corporate bonds in this rate rise have been the worst possible place to be. And you can see the warm embrace that investors had to corporate bonds during 2017, consistent with the stock market. Inflow after inflow of historic size. And then all of a sudden, they realize, oh, there is interest rate risk here. Actually, there's tons of interest rate risk here. The duration is over 7 of the investment-grade corporate bond market. And now you see them all selling. Nothing is more dangerous in the investment market when something is perceived to be safe, Facebook, and it ends up being unsafe, Facebook. And then you have corporate bonds, which were perceived to be safe, and now people are sitting on big losses. And suddenly they go, oh, this isn't as safe as I thought. And that's when the selling happens. Remember how safe AAA-rated subprime mortgage debt was in 2006? Let's put it in our money fund because it's so safe. It's floating rate and it's AAA. Well, we all know what happened to that. It went down 80%. So last Ed Ruscha to tie it back into the beginning paintings. This is riffing on popular culture, film. The end. Thankfully for some of you, I'm sure, the end of my speech. So we can talk about these things. It's now 4:50. I don't know if we have time for questions. I suppose we can do a few. Try to make them compelling. Is there anyone interested? Are there mics floating around?
Is it on? Thanks, Jeff. If we are in the late innings or the extra innings, is there anything that may turn things the other way? Could it be maybe another 1994 where inflation was perking up and the Federal Reserve was tightening, and then they suddenly reverse course, and we had another wonderful segment to the boom? Could anything change your mind there?
Well, sure, but, you know, first comes the problem. I mean, first you got to live through the problem. Yeah, the Fed may over-tighten and then may come to the rescue, but that's not a reason to be buying with both hands. I mean, first comes the problem. The Fed is not going to bail out the market unless there's a big problem. I mean, Jay Powell has pretty much said, I mean, the stock market peaked the last day of Janet Yellen's tenure as Federal Reserve chairperson, literally. I mean, I've nicknamed her Lucky Yellen. I mean, can you imagine leaving on the top day of the stock market, and then the very next day, here comes Jay Powell? I don't think that's a coincidence. I think it's because people realize that Powell has been vocal about not having this desire to have a 2017 type of stock market, where we're going to come in and help you out every time you drop 2%. So maybe that's why the stock market dropped 12% in a few couple of weeks and then did another 8 or 9 and maybe it's starting another one. Who knows? I don't want to see that in the newspaper. I'm not predicting that we are going to have a 10% drop in the stock market. I'm just saying that it's not acting like 2017. So I don't think Jay Powell's going to do diddly unless there's some serious damage, like the dollar is down at 85 on the Dixie Index, and the stock market is suffering, and bond yields are headed towards 350, 4%. So, yeah, I mean, I hear that argument on CNBC a lot. You know, well, you're totally safe because if something goes wrong, you know, Federal Reserve Court. But what about getting there? The hill might be green on the other side of the valley, but what about the valley? That's kind of like saying, hey, it was great to own Amazon in 1999 because, hell, it was $100, and now it's at, you know, $50 billion or whatever. But first it went to 15. I mean, how did that go when you went from 100 to 15? I mean, I doubt you were, like, clicking your heels together. So I think that that's the issue with that kind of thinking. Is there another question? Well, China has been buying a lot of U.S. debt. And China may decide not to continue doing that. I view that as the delta there is a negative one. The delta is negative. China's been a voracious buyer of U.S. debt. And you may not know this, but our president is saber-rattling on trade wars with China, which might motivate them to buy less. I don't know if it will, but if I were, president for life of China, I would probably be like, yeah, I'm not, like, incrementally motivated to buy your debt. In addition, don't forget, we're talking about a couple trillion here. It's a lot. And so That's the question I keep asking myself. Who's the buyer? I gave a talk in a room that was full of deflationists. Full of them. It was John Malden's conference, which attracts a lot of doom and gloomers. And I speak at it, but I'm actually one of the more optimistic people there. And I said, I know this, I'm going to do it to this room. Who here, and I'll use the level I use there, who here thinks buying a 285 U.S. 10-year looks like a really good deal? Who? Show of hands. Zero. In that room, there were like 10 guys. And that's a big conference. I mean, they have great speakers. They're like 800 people. There were like 10. And they were the debt deflationists. The problem is, it's not that attractive. That's kind of the issue. You have a value proposition problem with inflation where it is. The only way it's, and the reason those people put their hands up is a capital gain reason. Nobody wants the taxable yield on the federal level of 285. Nobody wants that. But they think, you know, a 30-year treasury bond, there's people that think it's going to 1%. There are, and they're going to make a killing. It's all a price change game. But it's just not attractive as an income vehicle. And so I think it's a real open question who the big buyer is. Some people say it's going to be corporate pension plans who want to do asset liability matching with their long-duration liabilities. I got news for you. They already did it. They all did it in a massive mass psychosis at 150 on the 10-year. You know, I mean, really? I mean, back in 1984, inflation was at 4% and falling, and the long end of the Treasury curve was at 14%. You could have locked in 1,000 basis points of real return, and inflation was falling. But people were afraid because back when the interpretation was inflation is bad, the opposite of today, people were worried. So nobody wanted them at 14%. And then they all lock it in at 1.5 when their actuarial rate is, call it 7 to pick a low number. They're locking in 550 basis points. And, you know, I know they do it for income statement reasons. There's actually good administrative reasons for corporate pensions to do asset liability management. I get that. But it's weird how committee think, how they convince themselves to do things at the worst possible time. I mean, remember commodities in 08? The global economy was falling apart. Stocks were tanking. The last man standing was commodities. And I would go to meetings, and investments committee saying, we're thinking of buying commodities. And I'm like, why? Well, our consultant says that we're really not diversified enough, and we should probably own some commodities for diversification. I have to roll my eyes. I say, that's just a euphemism. That's an excuse. Investment committees use prudent diversification as a Trojan horse for getting the votes passed to buy something on momentum. Of course, commodities, as we saw on the charts, were a disaster from 2008 into 2016 in particular, I think. So people, they do things at weird times because they don't want to admit they're momentum buyers, you know, but they are. One last question. Well, I think, going into recessions, it's clearly early. You can see from those charts, I don't know if you looked at them carefully, but those movements going into recession are not small. So commodities have already rallied. It's decent. You've had like 20, 30% rally in commodities. Some are up a lot more than that, like copper, but broadly speaking. But the move that commodities make going into recession is 100, 200, 300, sometimes 400%. I don't know which will be this time. Will it be at the low end or the high end? But it's more than what we've gotten so far. So if we take sort of a midpoint and say 200%, I guess we're at the top of the second, maybe at the bottom of the second. Well, I don't want to take any more of your time. Thank you for coming. I appreciate your support. Good luck. Good luck.